Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Just a quick note about the podcast. We really appreciate all of the new subscriptions, all of the new listeners. We have more than roughly about 11.5 million downloads. And of course, you can subscribe to us any place that they have a podcast, whether it's Apple Play, Google, Stitcher, Castro. In fact, there's places that I don't even know about, but we really do appreciate it. And if you like what you hear, we really appreciate it if you would leave a good review. Also, I want to mention, in case you're not aware, we also put out 3 newsletters a day at The Bulwark. My Morning Shots newsletter goes out in the morning. JVL has the Triad Midday, and Jim Swift has Overtime. And each of them is very, very different. I mean, I try to, I think mine is probably the longest today. I have some thoughts about President Trump's performative authoritarianism, the way these 2 quotes a month apart, I think, capture the essence of Trump's presidency. On March 13th, he said, "No, I don't take responsibility at all." A month later, on April 13th, he said, "When somebody's the president, the authority is total authority." So that's something quintessentially Trumpian about the claim of total authority and zero responsibility. He alone can save us, but don't blame him if he doesn't. So what I try to do with the newsletter every morning is we do quick hits, probably about 4 or 5 quick hits. Some of them aren't that quick. A few cheap shots and deep thoughts. And it's an interesting phenomenon. I'm kind of a late adopter to newsletters, but starting to realize how much of the information I get via newsletters, and also listening to podcasts, all the ways in which we've changed our consumption of media. And I think that the newsletter has really come into its own because there's just so much stuff out there. I've been doing this for a very long time. And show prep, when I used to be on the radio, used to involve reading, 4 or 5 newspapers every morning, going to key websites. But now, on a daily basis, there are just so many. There is so much quality material out there. And it you can be overwhelmed, watching your Twitter feed or trying to check into the normal reads. And so one of the things that I think a lot of folks have figured out is that you need to push content out as well. And so, in the morning when I sit down, one of the things that I will do is I will look at some of the key newsletters of people whose opinions that I'm interested in or sources that I trust, and they can point me to some of the best stuff out there. So I understand that there are a lot of people, a lot of demands on your time, but I do think that the newsletters that our newsletters try to be value added. And please check them out. Once again, just like everything else with the Bulwark website, the podcast, the newsletters are completely free. All right, we have a lot to talk about today, and we are joined again by one of our favorite guests, the political editor of the National Journal, Josh Kroshauer, who is also sheltering in place. How are you, Josh?
Hey, Charlie. Good to be back on the show.
So what's the hardest thing about being locked in place? Is there one thing that's difficult for you?
I'm a creature of comfort. I like to have my routine in the morning. I like to drive and get my cup of coffee and get the day going. And it's not the same. I mean, fortunately, I've been able to, my schedule hasn't dramatically changed. I'm writing my columns from home instead of from the office. And, I'm still doing the podcast that I put on, using new technologies. But, the notion of getting out, talking to people, going to coffees with sources, that disruption has changed my daily life. And a lot of people have it a lot worse, and I'm very cognizant of that. But, I think that we kind of underappreciate the disruption and the change that everyone in this country is making. And I'm already getting a little stir crazy being in the house for 5 weeks.
Well, that's interesting because if you're an extrovert, I'm kind of an introvert, so this is not that hard for me. But an extrovert, somebody who really likes people, who wants to spend time with people, this would be very, very difficult. As I mentioned to you before we started, this really hasn't changed my routine all that much because I do most of the work from home. But a couple of things. I was watching a movie last night, and an older movie. And they were having Chinese food, and they had all the little cartons open. And I realized, I am really starting to crave like different kinds of food. I don't go out that much to eat, but knowing that I can't go out makes me think, oh man, when this is over, I've got to get some sushi. I have got to get some Chinese food. I just got to break the routine. Okay, so let me bounce. You've got a great piece in the National Journal today about looking at the polls and why Trump's current polling slump is likely to last all year. Noting that he's losing ground in the polls, he's facing a worsening economy, watching the Democrats unify. And Republicans are, of course, hoping for a quick snapback. And I want to talk about why you were somewhat skeptical of this. But I wanted to get your reaction. I try to avoid inflicting the president's briefings on myself because I'm really in the light. It's hard enough and life is too short. I know I have to comment on it, but I can usually go back and check. But I had to listen in real time for a variety of reasons, real time yesterday. And I'm sitting in my kitchen with my earbuds in, listening to the president. Let's play that first clip.
We see light. We're starting to see it more than ever before. We've held our rate, the numbers, everything we've done. We've been very, very strong on it and very powerful on it.
So, he goes on like that for a while. And I can tell you, Josh, you know what I'm thinking? Is the president well? Is he okay?
Well,
I mean, he just—I know this sounds like old, but I mean, I was like, wow, they sent him out in that condition. Is that unfair? This is my cheap shot.
I mean, look, he is who he is. We've seen this through over 3 years of his presidency, and I think the thing that's most politically damaging to him isn't the kind of craziness that we've seen for years, or for the last few years, and we've seen continuously on and on, but it's the fact that we're in the middle of a pandemic. People are dying, and you have this kind of almost self-centered view of handling the crisis that's gotten worse in recent days. And there's an issue about when he's going to try to open up the economy, when he may clash with governors in coming days about when it's proper to and healthy to start to reopen the economy. But I think on a fundamental political level, the fact that you have the death rate now over 25,000, the
26.
Fact that news is not getting better, that all the experts, including those on his staff as part of the public health committee, are saying that this is going to go on for a long time. Even if we do reopen the economy is not going to snap back to normal in the near future. That seems to be something he's in denial of. And the public relies on, there are people watching these briefings, Charlie. He does have, as he likes to say, record ratings. He's got millions of people watching. And when you see this scattershot messaging, it's sort of everything's going to be fine when things aren't going well. And even more importantly, the fact that there's no plan. If you want to reopen the economy, what are we looking for?
Right.
People are looking to him for guidance and we're not getting it.
Yeah, I mean, here's the moment where you have 26,000 Americans dead, tens of millions of jobs have been vaporized. This is a country that really wants comfort and certainly some reassurance or information, and they get this. They didn't even take a single question from the medical experts yesterday. I mean, they're all there. They're forced to be there, and none of them were asked or answered any questions. And then you have the president sort of rambling, and then he goes off on reading a list of the people that he's going to be talking to, and I'm sitting there going, we are so screwed. Oh, and then there's this, Josh, one other soundbite that I thought goes in the category if irony was not already dead. Let's play the second one.
Tremendous death and economic devastation because those tasked with protecting us by being truthful and transparent failed to do so. It would have been so easy to be truthful. And so much death has been caused by their mistakes. We will continue to.
His lack of self-knowledge in some ways is a superpower because he's not even aware that, okay, you talking about telling the truth. All right, I want to talk about where we're at now. You touched on this, the reopening of the economy and the pressure to reopen the economy is really ramping up. You see the Wall Street Journal beating the drums. Conservative groups are now lobbying. You're starting to hear more and more pressure, even though we now learn that testing hits, the coronavirus testing, which is obviously crucial to be able to reopen. you know, has hit a dramatic slowdown in the United States. I'm looking at the Politico piece. The number of coronavirus tests analyzed each day by commercial labs in the country plummeted by more than 30% over the past week, even though new infections are still surging in many states and officials are desperately trying to ramp up testing so the country can reopen. So we're at this crucial moment where we are going to have to decide how and when to reopen the country. The president on Monday claimed, of course, total authority to tell the governors what to do. I don't know. Somebody must have showed him a copy of the Constitution. I have no idea who it was who convinced him that, yeah, you don't have that power. So he's sort of walking back kind of the face saving of saying, well, I am authorizing the states to do what the Constitution has long authorized the states to do. But at least we are there. But we are at a very, very dangerous moment that's going to have tremendous consequences for the election.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the politics of reopening the economy, because one of the reasons, Charlie, why Trump doesn't want to take responsibility by setting a date or by trying to say he's the one who's for it entirely is that it's not necessarily a popular position. I mean, there's a reason why almost every Democratic governor and a majority of Republican governors are not agreeing with the president's timeline. They do want to open things up at some point. They're looking more towards mid-May, end of May, and with certain guidelines and restrictions as to guiding the process by science and by health data, not by a certain arbitrary date. And you look at, you know, there's a Democratic poll that's been doing tracking every day on how people feel about a lot of questions relating to the coronavirus, but specifically about that balance between the health and the economy. And, you know, just today, you know, 55% care more about their own health than they do about their own finances, 55-45, and 72%. When people think about the impact of the coronavirus on them personally, 72% care more about their own health and well-being, and 28% care more about their own family financial situation. So, you know, the numbers are what kind of guides the politics, and Trump sees these numbers. And yes, we do need to start the economy when it's, you know, safe, and when his advisors that are experts in the health matters are going to recommend him to do so. But doing it too quickly, there's a political risk that, you know, you could have a greater chance of community spread again. You could have more people getting sick, more people dying earlier or again, and in a way that wouldn't have been expected if you do it later. And, you know, there's a real political backlash that could take place. So I think Trump is aware of that. He has a lot of advisors that look at the worrisome economic numbers and want the economy to open up again. And there's good reason to do so. I think the risk for Trump is he kind of gets too restless, and instead of doing it, you know, maybe mid-May, late May, he does it on May 1st or tries to push Republican governors to do it on May 1st, and you have another health crisis on your hands a month.
Yeah, it is interesting listening to folks like Laura Ingraham saying, you know, people are really going to be mad if the number of deaths turns out to be lower than was expected. Well, I don't know. I would think that the normal human being would react to that with relief that this is in fact good news, and recognize that as evidence that many of the things that we have done have worked. But even some of the plans to reopen the country that are now leaking out from the CDC make very clear warnings that if you open up too early, there's a real chance for a resurgence of this. We've talked about this before. Just one other point. There's also sort of this coronavirus truther movement out there that is suggesting that somehow the number of deaths have been exaggerated. And we have a piece in the Bulwark today that points out, in fact, is exactly the opposite, that the evidence is overwhelming that we are underreporting the number of people who've died from coronavirus. And let me just throw out this number here. So normally what people say about the normal seasonal flu is that about 60,000 people die every year, but that's a composite because that 60,000 number includes a pretty small number of deaths directly ascribed to flu. In other words, you know, the positive flu test. But it also includes a much larger number of people who die from pneumonia. Because assumed that because the flu-like symptoms were present, you know, the flu virus was likely at play. So that's the opposite of the way we've been calculating the coronavirus deaths. I mean, right now what we're doing is, you know, that unless you have tested specifically positive for COVID-19, you're not being counted. I mean, those are made up of only of deaths that are an accompanying positive test. And they leave out deaths with that just have coronavirus-like symptoms. So again, flu death numbers, mostly deaths that we assume are related to the flu, even though only a small minority of them are proven to have the influenza present. So the actual death toll could be much, much higher. So another reason to be very, very cautious about getting cocky and saying, we've won, mission accomplished, let's go back to life as normal.
Well, and I think most people understand that coronavirus is much more deadly than the flu. And all you have to do is realize that these 60,000, or we have, 26,000 deaths in a one-month period of time under stay-at-home orders in almost every state in the country, compared to 60,000 over an entire year when there are no, you know, regulations on who you can shake hands with or you know, anything else whenever it comes to the regular flu. I mean, you don't need a math degree to understand, like, even just basically looking at the data right now and not looking at the models, it's clearly much more deadly and much more contagious. I also think the politics, I mean, there's a cliche that I always abide by, which is that there are no libertarians in a crisis. There are no libertarians in a pandemic. And you just look at the polling data, and I could kind of cite chapter and verse, whether it's in national polls, blue states, red states, you know, people are prioritizing health right now, even when they know that the economy is really on the brink. I mean, we've basically shut down the economy to try to protect public health and protect people from dying. But I think people when you're at war, when you're in a pandemic, when you're in a crisis, a lot of the ideologies that normally divide our country end up kind of going outside the wayside. And that's what we're seeing. Right. I think at some point in a month, you may see a little bit of movement if the news is good when it comes to beating the coronavirus. But right now, you look at all the data, public opinion data, and it's overwhelmingly in favor of caution, not rushing to open up the economy before you get the health issue under control.
So how do you think people are going to react to this story about the stimulus checks having the president's name on it? Treasury Department ordered Trump's name to be printed on the checks that the IRS is sending out. There are some reports that this, in fact, will slow their delivery by a few days. I mean, part of me is like, okay, this is outrageous. This is counterproductive. The other part is like, of course, Donald Trump wants to put his name on the checks because his entire career has been putting his name on things that other people have paid for.
But Charlie, the amazing thing about this is that he thinks it's going to help him politically.
Right.
Do you think anyone is going to look at the paycheck and see Donald Trump's signature and say, okay, I'm going to vote for Donald Trump instead of voting for Joe Biden because I see the president's signature on this check? I'm very doubtful, especially since the reporting by the Washington Post shows that the delay, that there's actually a few days delay in getting these checks out there because the president demanded his signature on the bottom of the check. You know, I think this is the president who's always concerned about his self-image. His ego is driving the politics. I don't think there's any polling or any kind of good sense politically in the White House that this is a good move for him. I mean, this is just simply him, his ego, his need to be in the center of everything, defining the strategy in dealing with coronavirus.
Yeah, two quick thoughts about that. Number one, you know, I'm guessing that a lot of those checks are going to be direct deposited, so nobody will even see the check. That's number one. Right. Yep. Number two, this is another one of those moments where, you know, Donald Trump really thinks people are stupid. To think, hey, Ma, look, we just got a check from Donald Trump. Donald, I'm going to vote for that Donald Trump because Donald Trump just sent me a check for $1,200. This is Donald Trump giving me this money. It's just like, okay, who is that voter? All right, so let's talk about your piece, because this is the big question. We don't know what the world is going to look like in November. This is going to be an election that will be determined. I think it's going to be dominated by the reality of all of this. But you argue that you think the slump is going to last. The polls are not great for him. The economy is getting worse. Democrats are doing something very uncharacteristic for them. They've decided that they are this year not going to be in disarray, way ahead of schedule. But Republicans will tell you, yeah, it's not so bad. Will be popped, the country will come back, and he will be able to ride the wave of resurgent economy, the comeback kids kind of thing, and that's going to benefit him in November. You're not buying that.
So number one, there are very few economists now that are saying that there's likely going to be the type of swift economic recovery, even in a best case scenario. Even if we kind of get this coronavirus under control, we get back to some semi-normal standard where we go out a little bit, we start to go back to school. The notion of like why, you know, a V-shaped economic recovery, healthy economic growth is extremely unlikely to happen by November of 2020. So I think we want to put that as part of one of the fundamentals looking forward. And then that's the best case scenario, Charlie. That's the scenario where, you know, things are looking at least on an optimistic note, even if they're not where they were before the pandemic hit. The more realistic scenarios is that we're still dealing with a crisis going into the fall, in just a few months from now. So, the one statistic, if you look at all the, I mean, and the polling is bad for the president. I mean, a lot of people are trying to kind of say, it's not great, it's not good. The numbers, whether you're looking at the national polls or whether you're looking at the battleground state polls, they all show the president in precarious position right now. But I think the more important thing is the fundamentals. And when you look at the polling, people still are relatively sanguine. They're relatively sort of optimistic about the economy getting back on track after this is over. And there was a morning, one of the Navigator research polls done by two Democratic pollsters. They actually had the president with a 46% job approval rating, which
is high.
Disaster. But they also show the president with a 50% economic job approval rating. And you look inside the numbers, people still feel like somewhat confident about the economy getting better in the long term. Once I think the reality of the recession, the reality of the downturn is going to hit in the coming weeks and months, I just see that number going down, and I see the president taking the brunt of that backlash.
Yeah, I've noticed in the past there's kind of a lag sometimes as public opinion takes a while to adjust to things. And I think the numbers you just highlighted are absolutely crucial. And I noticed that, by the way, in some of the numbers in Wisconsin, where, you know, Trump is quite competitive. It's basically even. But his numbers on the economy were very, very strong. You change that number, and it's going to change a lot. It will change the approval rating. It's going to change the head-to-heads as well. And you wonder, go through a summer in which you have double-digit unemployment. Go into a fall where you're looking at numbers that we haven't seen in our lifetime. And it's hard to imagine that public opinion does not sour on all of that.
Yeah. And Trump, you can see the strategy in real time. The president is trying to blame the governors, especially the Democratic governors, if things go south, if the economy doesn't get back on track because they want to keep their states closed, or if the health issues don't get back on track because of federal policies. Well, I don't recall an election, a national election, with a candidate certainly as polarizing as the president blaming a governor instead of the leader who's in charge of the country. So I mean, okay, that's a pretty novel strategy. I don't think it's going to work if that's what the game plan is.
Okay, well, that's what I wanted to get to, because we kind of know what the overall game plan is, and I haven't had a chance to read the whole thing, but it looks like McKay Coppins has a really interesting piece in The Atlantic where he talks about sort of the Orwellian plan in Trump world to blame everyone else and to portray the president's handling of this as absolutely perfect. But clearly, he's going to be blaming the Chinese. He's going to be blaming the World Health Organization. He's going to claim that he moved very, very quickly. And to the extent that there are any problems, he's saying it is the governors. And this does seem to be he's trying to sort of stand on both stools, which is that, you know, that I mentioned this earlier, you know, that I have total authority and I am the only one who can fix it. But if there's a screw up, it's going to be that Cuomo guy, or it's going to be some other governor. And is there a chance, though, that, I mean, look, we've seen his ability to change the narrative, to create an alternative reality, and we've seen the incredible willingness of his supporters to buy whatever it is he's selling.
Let's take the China card, which I think is maybe one of his more effective political tactics, right? I mean, and I think, frankly, whatever you think of the decision to pull money from the WHO, it's pretty clear that both China and international organizations that take money and have representation in China were sort of derelict in their duty in terms of warning the world about what was going on there. So, you know, I think that whatever you think about the policy, I think that he both has a political case to make, and there's an argument that he's right on some of those fronts. But that said, you know, from the political point of view, just strictly, you know, playing the populist, the distraction card. Now, I remember in the 2018 midterms, he kind of warned that there was a caravan of illegal immigrants from Mexico and Central America coming to the country. And that was the drumbeat that not just the president, but all of his supporters were ringing in the weeks running up to the midterm election. And you look at the results. Democrats won a landslide election, won back the House. You know, I think the dynamic.
They won Senate seats, right? I mean, they won Senate seats in Florida. They won Senate seats in places like Indiana and Missouri. So it wasn't a complete failure.
In red states, and that's been the pattern throughout the Trump presidency. I mean, throughout all the chaos, throughout all the headlines, everything we talk about on a daily basis, there's been a pretty consistent pattern throughout Trump's presidency, politically speaking, which is that, you know, he's gotten his base, and that base is not going to go away from him no matter what. But, you know, he's lost independents, and he's lost suburban voters, and he's lost every Democrat out there. And if you look at the 2018 map, I mean, and I think that's frankly, a better scenario than what could happen in the middle of a pandemic in November. But if you take that 2018 map and extrapolate it across the country, he lost the Wisconsin governor's race. He lost suburban seats in big metro areas across the country. And even if you give him Florida and you give him Ohio, which he won in the governor's races in those two states, that's not enough to get an electoral college majority. So even like you look at 2018 and you look at the glass hat. The glass being half full, it's still hard to see how he gets to 270, especially with the fundamental indicators looking negative.
You flagged a couple of interesting polls this week. You know, obviously I was obsessed with what was happening in Wisconsin. A lot of commentary about what happened in Wisconsin, but as you pointed out, some of the most interesting numbers are coming out of Arizona right now. A new poll showing big lead for Biden. In Arizona, if Biden wins Arizona, that really changes the calculation completely, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Trump could win Wisconsin, but if he doesn't win Arizona and he doesn't win Michigan and Pennsylvania, where he's been trailing by quite a bit, he can't win the election. You know, he's pretty much stuck. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, here's the stat that I mentioned in the column that I think your listeners should be aware of, which is. In the Real Clear Politics average of all the battleground states, Wisconsin, Arizona, North Carolina, Florida, every single swing state, Trump is behind Joe Biden. That, you know, you may not know that people, you know, are saying that the battleground states, he's doing better in the battleground states than he is in the national polling. Well, just look at the averages and frankly, just look at all the polls out there. In every single battleground state, Trump is behind. So right now, if you extrapolate, that would be a landslide pretty much for Joe Biden. Now, maybe Trump comes from behind in Florida. Maybe he wins Wisconsin. But he's going to need to win every single battle, you know, the majority of those battleground states to win. And he's behind, and the trend lines are not encouraging right now for him. So, you know, I think that a lot of people are understandably trying to hedge their bets, are trying to overlearn the lessons of 2016. But, you know, fundamentally, and just looking at the numbers right now, Trump is in a world of hurt. He's not doing well politically at all.
Yeah, and you noted on Twitter, you know, there are 13 states that have more than 10,000 coronavirus cases. Six of them are Trump states: Michigan, Pennsylvania, Louisiana, Florida, Texas, Georgia. So you wonder again, those, you know, large numbers of coronavirus cases, not a positive for him. So, okay, I've been talking about Wisconsin a lot because I live here and maybe I'm too close. Give me your sense from where you sit about what happened in Wisconsin this week.
Well, you know, I defer to you on all things Wisconsin, but I will say that I was surprised that given the attempts to have this election in the middle of the pandemic, you know, I thought that the turnout dynamic was going to favor Republicans as a result. So I did just without doing a whole lot of research and reporting, I just fundamentally thought that Republicans were trying to have the election in order to benefit themselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when you have, you know, a 10-point margin for the liberal candidate and high turnout, relatively speaking, better turnout for Democrats and Republicans in a high profile state Supreme Court election. That tells you, I think that's a very encouraging sign. I don't think you can kind of extrapolate that into November necessarily, but you know, if you want to see an example of the Democratic base in Wisconsin being energized, I mean, you've got it in that election, because it wasn't easy to vote, and people in Milwaukee, you saw those lines in Milwaukee, you saw evidence that the turnout in these Democratic areas, relatively speaking, for a pandemic, an election taking place during a pandemic, that was pretty healthy turnout by the Democratic Party, and they knew how to master the whole mail-in system.
Well, exactly. I mean, you had two things there. You had the enthusiasm, but also you had the organization. And then, of course, you just have, you know, what it's done for the mood. They have a new chairman here in Wisconsin, the Democrats, named Ben Wickler, and I don't really know him. But, you know, he clearly has gotten this party to focus on fundamentals. And I mentioned this earlier on the podcast. It used to be that Republicans had developed a significant edge in get out the vote, and somehow that has now flipped around. But I also think that, you know, I mean, again, dangers about extrapolating to November. There were a lot of fundamentals favoring the Democrat / liberal candidate. It's nonpartisan, but nobody takes that seriously anymore. I mean, we have a state Supreme Court race where all the presidential candidates are endorsing. Trump is endorsing the conservative. Biden, I think Elizabeth Warren, I think a lot of the other Democratic presidential candidates endorsed the liberal candidate Jill Karofsky. The parties made no secret of the fact that they were mobilizing on behalf of these candidates. I mean, our race is so politicized. But this was also on the same day that you had a Democratic presidential primary and no Republican presidential primary. And this is one of the reasons why the Republicans were so nervous, because it was assumed that this gave a huge structural advantage to the liberal. But even so, I will tell you, and because I was watching what the number crunchers, the really smart guys, the Joshes of Wisconsin were saying and thinking about this election. And to a person, they all thought it was going to be very, very close. Nobody saw 120,000 vote victory, 10-point victory in a state that has really become known for, you know, really close elections. So this was a blowout. And what it has done to morale, I can't necessarily quantify. But you do get the sense that, no good news for Republicans came out of Wisconsin.
Go
ahead.
Well, I was going to say, there was a 2019 state Supreme Court election right after the midterms,
which they blew.
Folks thought that the liberals were going to win, and they lost. So, I mean, so there is a difference. I mean, there is movement in a sense, if you're comparing, you know, apples to apples. So,
you are right. So let's talk about the Democrats. One of the main factors, and this has played out, it's happened so fast that it's kind of remarkable to reflect that here we are in the middle of April. This race that, you know, we were a few months ago speculating might go all the way to the convention is not only over, but the party is coming together in a rather remarkable way, including Bernie Sanders, who has come out quite strongly and clearly in favor of Joe Biden. Now, whether he's going to be able to bring along his supporters, that's not clear. Give me your thoughts on Bernie coming out, you know, doing what he did, and the timing of his decision to get behind Joe Biden.
Well, I think there are two things at play. Number one, he does have a good rapport with Joe Biden, based on their time together in the Senate, and in a way that he didn't have a positive relationship with Hillary Clinton. So, I mean, I think the prospect of the Kumbaya moment we saw this month was there, and then the potential for that alliance was there. You know, Barack Obama, President Obama, who endorsed Joe Biden this week as well, had many conversations, according to the reporting out there, that encouraged Sanders to get off the sidelines, to be playing a constructive role in the process, and that probably was weighing on Sanders's mind, and I think the last time I was on the show, I did think that Sanders eventually was going to get out of the race sooner than later and endorse Joe Biden, just because the mood in the party, even among progressives, is they want to beat Donald Trump. I mean, that's the story of this primary that I've been kind of screaming from the rooftops throughout the last year, that, you know, people are not as ideological in the Democratic Party that a lot of pundits on Twitter make it out to be. And if you look at every poll going back to last year, there's this intense feeling to find the nominee and to get them, you know, in a strong position against President Trump. Let's not dawdle. Let's not fight over small things. And I think even some of Sanders' supporters, the ones that aren't on Twitter as much, probably shared that view. I mean, Sanders saw the political writing on the wall, and I frankly think he understands the gravity of this election too. That this is not a time of, you know, where Democrats can really have political luxury, where you can really, really afford to divide yourselves based on small differences.
It is interesting, though, that there is a class of Bernie bro, including like the Democratic Socialists of America, that are rather ostentatiously on social media saying we are not endorsing Joe Biden. And there's certainly and there's even kind of a subsection of them that's turning on Bernie Sanders and accusing him of selling out, which is amazing. But this is another one of those good moments to remember that Twitter is not real life. And these folks do not necessarily, represent a huge part of the electorate. However, this brings me to the question of third party, fourth party. Justin Amash thinking about running. Obviously, there's going to be a Jill Stein like candidate. Everybody who's looked at the numbers knows that those third party, third, fourth party votes, there were more of the third party votes. I'm looking up, see if I can pull up some of these numbers in the swing states than Trump's margin. In other words, if those people had voted for Hillary Clinton, she would have won the election. The margins in places like Michigan and Wisconsin can be explained by some of these third. So, do you see what role would a third party candidacy play? And specifically, I'm talking about Justin Amash.
Yeah, I really don't see him playing a huge role if he decides to run as a libertarian. Michigan would be the one state where he's going to have an impact because people know who he is in Michigan. I don't think he has a whole lot of national profile. I don't think if you ask people across the country, do you know who Justin Amash is? I think it's pretty small outside the Beltway and outside of Michigan. So, yeah, I mean, I do think he would probably take more votes away from Biden, but I don't know if that would be a huge difference. He is much more conservative. He shares much more views with the traditional Republicans than he does with, he's more likely to take votes away from Biden just because there's a segment of the population that may not like Trump but doesn't want to vote for a Democrat, doesn't want to vote for the establishment. But, you know, do I think it's going to make a major impact? I'm skeptical about that. I think if there's any state to watch, it's Michigan. But I don't think people really know who he is. And I don't know if he's going to be able to get as much attention as he thinks.
Here's the numbers that I was looking at. And Tim Miller and Sarah Long will have a piece in the Bulwark about this, basically telling Justin Amash you might want to sit this one out. They looked at the increase in the vote total among center-right third-party candidates. This would be Gary Johnson, the Libertarian, Evan McMullen, or the Constitution Party, plus write-ins. So this was just the increase. So in Pennsylvania, there were 135,000 more center-right third-party votes, 135,000 more votes in 2016. Trump won by just about 44,000. Wisconsin, there were 123,000 more votes cast for these center-right third-party candidates. Trump won by just 22,000. Michigan, there were 165,000 more votes cast for these center-right third-party candidates. Trump won by just a little bit under 11,000. So that's the ball game right there. Okay, speaking of coalescing, today, Elizabeth Warren finally got around to endorsing Joe Biden. Pretty strong endorsement. I guess the question would be, why did she wait so long? I mean, if you and I had a bingo card, who would endorse Biden? I don't think that we would have thought that Warren would wait till after Sanders and Barack Obama. So what's going on with Elizabeth Warren?
Well, Charlie, I've never thought that highly of her political acumen, based on her campaign. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't get the timing. Her campaign, but for what it's worth, people close to her say it's because Biden wanted her to wait. I don't know how that helps her, though. If she wants to be considered for vice president, I don't know how it helps her her political standing in terms of advancing her agenda with the Biden campaign. I mean, she's basically, what I'm hearing is that, you know, Biden is calling the shots and she's saying, I'll listen to whatever you say. That's not really her brand. If you told me she was going to be endorsing Joe Biden after both Obama and Bernie Sanders, I'd be asking you what the heck is going on here.
Well, exactly.
I think she's marginalized her you know, herself, politically speaking. I don't think she's going to be picked at all. I don't think she's in the top list as a Biden running mate. And I think she's kind of lost her leverage. I just don't get what she should have endorsed early and been the person trying to push Bernie to get on board, not the other way around. So I don't get her standing or her views.
Okay, Stacey Abrams. I don't know if you've seen this. She gave an interview to L Magazine. Have you seen this?
Yeah. I did.
Okay. So Stacey Abrams, candidate for governor in Georgia, has made a big deal of ballot access, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is what she said when she was asked about whether she'd want to be VP. This is a direct quote. "I would be an excellent running mate. I have the capacity to attract voters by motivating typically ignored communities. I have a strong history of executive and management experience in the private, public, and nonprofit sectors." What?
Yeah, that sounds like Donald Trump. This is the bigotry. This is the bigotry of low expectations, Charlie. Ooh. If you said Donald Trump said that, you would think that would be perfectly like Trumpian in terms of like how that sounds. But if she thinks that type of confidence, I guess, is going to help her, the running mate for Joe Biden, she's deluding herself. And maybe she knows she's not going to be picked and she's trying to self-promote in a way. But there is this really huge disconnect between people inside the Beltway who think Stacey Abrams is, one of the top recruits, the top political prospects in the country, and sort of the reality both back in Georgia, where she didn't win the governor's race in 2018. But just, I think when you talk privately to Democratic operatives, a lot of them will say publicly nice things about her, but they kind of wonder what the political thinking is behind the scenes.
Well,
this is another example of that.
Well, I've shared those doubts, and I saw that quote, and I winced. That you let other people say that sort of thing, you don't say that about yourself. And look, I know that people have campaigned hard to be vice presidential nominees, but usually they do it with a certain degree of, I don't know, discretion. Maybe that's so last century, but
one last thing. I mean, the fundamental reason she's not going to get picked is that at a time of crisis, at a time of a pandemic, you're not going to pick, Joe Biden is not going to pick someone whose highest elective office is state house minority leader in Georgia. I mean, that's just not going to happen. That makes Sarah Palin look like, a primetime player in 2008 as governor of Alaska. So the notion that there's going to be an identity politics play at a time of a pandemic, I'd be stunned if that happened.
Okay, so in your ratings, in the Josh Crash Hour ratings, who are your 1, 2, 3 in order VP prospects? Yeah, put you on the spot there.
Yeah, I think it's a short list. I think it's a very short list. I think it really is going to come down to Amy Klobuchar, the senator of Minnesota, and Kamala Harris, senator of California. Mm-hmm. I think Gretchen Whitmer is a wild card. That if Michigan is a success story, she could get strong consideration. But I don't. I think you need number one. There was a poll that Politico did that came out today that showed overwhelmingly Democrats believe that the prerequisite for any running mate is someone who can step into the job that can handle a crisis, not box checking for gender and race, not like silly little political stunts, but someone who can do the job. And I think you need someone with experience, someone who's younger, and Biden has said he's picking a woman. So, I think it's Kamala Harris and Klobuchar. I might actually give Klobuchar a slight edge. I know people think Harris would, are saying Harris might be the front runner. I would give Klobuchar a slight edge. I think they have a good rapport, Biden and her together, and she's a Midwestern play. I think it makes a lot of sense.
A lot of pressure, I think, though, is for a minority. The Gretchen Whitmer thing is fascinating to me, but she is a first-term governor. You mentioned Sarah Palin. Look, she's no Sarah Palin. Given the fact that it's Michigan, given her, I think I saw that she's got a 70% approval rating for her handling of the coronavirus. No, I would have the same list. I agree with you. I think if you held a gun to my head, I probably would say Kamala Harris, but you make a compelling case. Josh Krashauer, thank you so much for coming back onto the podcast and spending so much time with us.
Thanks, Charlie. My pleasure.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.